Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Volume? Okay, great, good. Welcome as we begin our Lenten journey today. This is our first Sunday in a six-week series focusing on the parables. And we are delighted to have Dale Allison with us this morning. But before we get started with introductions, let's open with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, we ask your blessing on our Lenten journey over these next 6 weeks. We pray for the teachers who instruct us. We pray for us as listeners that we will have open hearts and open minds. We thank you for your stories, Lord. Give us fresh insights. Help them to land in deep places. Bless us with encouragement, guidance, and a renewed sense of discipleship this Lenten series. In your son's name we pray, amen. So our speaker kicking us off today is Dr. Dale Allison. He is a familiar face around this church. He and his wonderful wife, Chris, are part of our congregation. Dale is a father. Dale is a grandfather. These are probably his most important roles, but he is also the professor of New Testament, Richard Dearborn Professor of New Testament at Princeton Theological Seminary. He focuses on Second Temple Judaism, the Gospel of Matthew, and the historical interpretation of biblical texts. That sounds a little technical. But he also writes on George Harrison, religious experience, and death and what might come after, and that to me sounds a little more accessible. When we were starting this series, or starting the planning for this series on parables, I went back and listened to a lecture that Dale gave back in 2016. And it was so spectacular that I thought it was necessary for us all to hear it again. Some of you may remember back in 2016, you were sitting in this room listening to this lecture. Many of you weren't, but it occurred to me that we listen to our favorite songs more than once. We sing hymns more than once. We certainly read Bible stories more than once. And we can listen to a lecture, a talk, more than once. And as we keep saying with the parables, repeat listenings bring new insights. So I'm delighted to have Dale here today and to launch us into Lent. Welcome, Dale.
Thank you very much. The parables in what is left of 45 minutes. How do you do that? Most Christians like the parables of Jesus. I'm among them. They've always been very, very popular. But I suspect that they may be a little more popular now than in times past among Christians. And I suspect this for at least three reasons. So, first of all, many of us moderns prefer stories to dogma. I tend to be such a person. And these sorts of people, for example, may like Paul more than Jesus. They may be like my father, who thought Paul couldn't tell a story if his life depended on it, but Jesus was all about stories, and so he liked Jesus. Anyway, there's something to that, maybe. We like stories as opposed to the theology of Romans. Also, we like short stories. And if you look over the last 200 years, our stories get shorter and shorter and shorter. So you can plot a development from 19th century novels then to the modern short story. And then we get Reader's Digest, where you take novels and shorten them, turn them into short stories, and now we have tweets where people think they can communicate with 100 words or characters or whatever it is. I am not familiar with this phenomenon, but I know that it's short, right? We like short, brief things, and things that we don't need long attention spans for. I also think there's a third element here that helps us in the last two centuries or more to be attracted to these texts. And that's so many of us are romantic. We live on this side of the romantic poets and the romantic movement. Not all the parables are about nature, but a lot of them are. We like the sower and the mustard seed and the seed growing secretly and the wheat and the weeds and a barren fig tree. I think if you like Wordsworth or if you like Keats, you're probably going to like some of these parables. We're just romantic. We moved into the city, you know, the city's middle 18th century, and we're not happy here. And, you know, we want our kids to be Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and to go camping. When we're in New York, we want to go to Central Park, and we want to keep our green spaces, and we want to be ecological and all that. We like the outdoors. Now, we also like these parables because they are intrinsically, I think, fascinating, and they have a power within themselves. I'm not a literary critic. I don't know how to explain this, but I've been haunted my whole life by the parable of the sheep and goats. I really have. There's something mysterious here and haunting, profound. I think there's something profound here, whatever it is. And I think this is one of those stories, you read it and you don't forget it. And I remember one evening, my youngest son must have been 5 or 6, and he said to me, I always read to the kids at night, he said, "Daddy, how about the sheep and goats again?" He wanted to hear the story again because it worked for him as a story. So I come to church here on Sunday, but I've also built a church. I call it the church of my imagination. It's in here. You can't see it. But it's the church I go to most mornings for my religious exercises. It's not a Reformed church at all, so maybe I'll offend some of you. It's filled with icons. And when you walk into the church, the second icon on the right from the back is the Good Samaritan. And every morning I stand in front of this icon and I say, "Love your neighbor as yourself, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, love your enemy." And then I go on to the next icon. It's part of my life. It's just there. Okay, so what the heck can I do in what is now 40 minutes, right? So what? I can go to 10:20?
Yeah.
Okay, you won't kill me. All right. Well, we'll see how this goes. I really can't do any. I can't even do a cartoon here. I'm just going to be doing a preface to a cartoon. All right. That's all this is, because this is silly. So as I was thinking about what I would do, how would I introduce the parables of Jesus? And I had an idea. So I went over to our library last Friday, or no, Thursday. I went over Thursday. We have a big section, parables of Jesus. I mean, hundreds of books on parables. So what I did is I checked out 100 of them. I drew them at random, 100. I checked all of them out, took them to my house, and I read them all on Friday. And then I produced this lecture on Saturday. And as you can see here, I've brought them with me here today, and there are 100 here, and I've put them into 10 stacks. There are 10 stacks here. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through these 10 stacks, and I'm going to tell you what is in each one. And when we're done, you will have some sense, maybe, of how to think about the parables. So we're going to start with the pile that's right here, and it is the largest by far, but you can also see that most of these books are very old. These are old books, but it's the largest pile. And if I were to characterize this pile, I would say these are books which approach the parables of Jesus as allegories. Now, at one point when I was a little kid, I think I could have just said an allegory is like Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, and everybody would have nodded and said, yeah. I guess in today's world, we don't know Pilgrim's Progress anymore. I don't know popular literature, so I don't know what allegories are out there. But an allegory is a story in which everything is symbolic. And you could almost drop a list of equations. This character stands for this. This character stands for that. This thing stands for that. And before the 20th century, most Christians, for most of their parables, approached them as allegories. Augustine did this. Aquinas did it in the Middle Ages. And if you go over to the library, you'll see that there are still 6 or 7 or 8 copies of a book by a guy named R.C. Trench. It was the best-selling book on the parables in the 19th century, and is full of allegorical interpretation. So what does this mean? I'm going to read you something from Augustine. And I think it's silly, but you always have to remember that this was one of the... This guy is brilliant. Even if you don't like him, this guy was brilliant. And it says something that he could think this made sense. You should never laugh at Augustine. You can get mad at him, but you can never laugh at him. A certain man went down from Jericho to Jerusalem, from Jerusalem to Jericho. This is Adam. Jerusalem, that's the heavenly city of peace, from whose blessedness Adam fell. Jericho means the moon and signifies our mortality, because it is born, waxes, wanes, and dies. Thieves, the devil and his angels, who stripped him, namely, of his immortality, and beat him by persuading him to sin, and left him half dead, because insofar as a person can understand and know God, he lives, but insofar as he is wasted and oppressed by sin, he is dead, and therefore called half dead. The priest and Levite who saw him and passed by signify the priesthood and ministry of the Old Testament, which profited nothing for salvation. Samaritan means guardian, and therefore the Lord himself is signified by this name. The binding of the wounds is the restraint of sin. Oil is the comfort of good hope. Wine, the exhortation, everything. Wine is the exhortation to work with fervent spirit. The beast is the flesh in which he deigned to come to us. The being set upon the beast is belief in the incarnation of Christ. The inn is the church. And how about this? I'll skip on ahead. The innkeeper is the Apostle Paul. You're all laughing. This was one of the most brilliant people who ever lived. How could he do this? Well, it sounds far-fetched to you. You're laughing. You do find, however, and this really lies behind in part what Augustine is doing, you find something like this in the Gospels. You really do. So I'm going to read you something. This is from Matthew. Matthew 13. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to someone who sowed good seed in his field. But while everybody was asleep, an enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and then went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared as well. And the slaves of the householder came and said to him, Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? Where then did these weeds come from? He answered, an enemy has done this. The slave said to him, then do you want us to go and gather them? But he replied, no. For in gathering the weeds, you would uproot the wheat along with them. Let both of them grow together until the harvest. And at harvest time, I will tell the reapers, collect the weeds first. So what does this mean? Explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field. Jesus said, the one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed are the children of the kingdom. The weeds are the children of the evil one, and the enemy who sowed them is the devil. And the harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. Just as weeds are collected and burned up with fire, so will it be at the end of the age, and so on. This is what Augustine was doing, isn't it? He's looking at a story, and this is that. You also find this with the parable of the sower in three of our Gospels, where the disciples ask Jesus, hey, what's this about? And he gives you a bunch of equations. So that is why the church has done this with these stories again and again and again and again. Now, one problem here is that you need a code. You need the secret decoder ring for these parables. And the problem is you only have the ring for two of them. If you go through the Gospels, you only get these allegorical interpretations twice. So who has the magic decoder ring? The other problem, of course, is that we'd like to think that Jesus wanted to be understood, at least some of the time or most of the time. And it just makes no sense for him to be walking around Galilee in AD 30 telling a story which is really symbolically about the church and Paul. They're not there. Nobody could possibly know who they are. Even if the disciples said, what the heck does this mean? And he told them, well, you know, it's about Paul the innkeeper. That makes no sense. It just makes no sense in AD 30. So there's a real problem here. And what has happened is most recent books, most of these up here in front of you now, say, whatever we're going to make of these, we're going to try to make sense of them as they would be understood in the first century, or maybe to Jesus' original audience or hearers. Okay, so pile number two. It's not as big as pile number one, and most of it looks like, well, you could open it and check. Most of this stuff is from the first half of the 20th century. And you can see they're dominated by these two giant books by this German scholar named Ulliker. Never been translated, but highly influential. And these books say, allegory, that's all wrong. Allegory, that's all wrong. And we figured it out. The Gospels are really not that complex. By the way, people in this pile, some of them wrote before the 1940s, and some of them said, you know, these two allegorical interpretations in the Gospels, they're actually from the church. They were added. That's not Jesus. The language is actually from the church. And in the 1940s, we discovered an old mysterious text called the Gospel of Thomas. It doesn't matter what you make of the Gospel of Thomas, but it's probably early 2nd century, or in some form, it's early 2nd century. And it's really interesting because it has the parable of the sower without the interpretation. And so lots of people said, whoa, that confirms these people who think these were added, because here we have a text with the parable and it doesn't have the interpretation. Anyway, what are you left with if you get rid of allegory? Well, a lot of these people said, you really get stories that are about behavior. They are moral lessons. And boy, this makes a lot of sense. The parable of the Good Samaritan, what do you do with that? You should be like the Good Samaritan, shouldn't you? Yeah. If you read this and don't do that, you're making a mistake. The rich man and Lazarus, that seems to be telling you something about how you should behave, right? The parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector, one person is vain and one person is humble. So you're supposed to be like the Good Samaritan. You're supposed to love your neighbor. And who is your neighbor? Well, maybe it's not your ordinary neighbor. Maybe it's people who don't belong to your usual world. Anyway, this makes a lot of sense, folks. Lots of these parables, they just jump out at us and say, yeah, these are stories of exemplary behavior and maybe sometimes stories of what you're not supposed to do. So Jesus told a parable. The land of a rich man brought forth plentifully. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. And he said, I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? And then you get this sentence, the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich for God, that's what this person is like. Doesn't this approach seem to be right? Doesn't it make sense? Yeah, makes sense to me. It makes sense to me. And, you know, sometimes I'll tell people that Jesus is my conscience. What do you mean by that? Well, first of all, I'm a hypocrite, so just because Jesus is my conscience doesn't mean I'm doing the right things. But what I really mean by that is the Sermon on the Mount has become part of my conscience, and these parables are part of my conscience. And as I go through life, as I drive down the street and I'm thinking about what I should do or not do, these things just are there, and they say, do this, don't do that. They function. They really function as conscience. These are moral imperatives, I think. But this isn't all that's going on here, because we got 10 piles, right? So we got 8 more to go through here. So, you know, one of the things you have to ask is, well, are the evangelists interpreting all of these parables as moral lessons? They've got allegories. Has the church been wrong about everything? And are all these stories really so simple? Maybe some of them are complex. Maybe some of them are difficult. You know, not all short stories are really simple and have just one message. So maybe more is going on here. So I'm going to the third pile now, the third pile. And if I were to characterize these in one word, I would say they're all about eschatology. Now, that's a big word. Seminary students learn it, but all it means is these books connect the parables to the last things, the final judgment, eschatological reward, heaven, Gehenna, loss, finding the kingdom which is not just here but also coming. There's a lot to be said for this. And I think for part of my career, at least early career, I was in this camp. Fortunately, I didn't write a book, so it's not here. But think about this for a second. The rich fool, what is that about? Well, the problem is he dies, right? And then he has to face responsibility, it would seem, in the world to come for what he did in this world. Or the sheep and the goats, what's that all about? It isn't just about we should feed the hungry, right? Give a glass of water, visit prisoners. It's about the last judgment. It's about the consequences of behavior at the last judgment. It's about entering into life. It's about being cast out into darkness. The rich man and Lazarus, well, that's an afterlife scene, isn't it? Here's what's going on in this world, and then what really matters, that's an afterlife scene, something beyond this world. The 10 maidens, 10 bridesmaids in Matthew 25, what is that all about? That's all about being ready for the coming of the Son of Man. It really is. That's what it's about, folks. No doubt at all. And so some people look at the parables and they say, you know what? Jesus was in some ways kind of otherworldly. He was really into eschatology. He talked about last things a lot. And maybe the parables are, to great extent, illustrations of his thinking about the consequences of the coming of the kingdom. They're looking into the future. They're seeing beyond the mundane and the ordinary and the everyday life. And by the way, even if you don't like allegory, as some of these people didn't, they could still say, hey, Matthew is on our side. Let me go back. Listen to this. This is Matthew's interpretation of the weeds and the wheat. Now, you may say it's just Matthew, but here's our earliest commentator on what Jesus was all about. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. Just as weeds are collected and burned up with fire, so will it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will collect out of his kingdom all causes of sin and evildoers and throw them into the furnace of fire. That is an eschatological interpretation of the parable. No doubt about it. So, you know, there's some reason for thinking some of these are allegorical. And there's some reason for thinking that some of these are moral lessons. And there is some reason for thinking that a lot of these have to do with the last things or eschatology. Okay, pile four. These books were all written in the last 30 years. They're really interesting to me. They say, you know what, folks? We've been making this mistake. People tend to look at the parables and say, well, this parable means this or this parable means that. But this overlooks the fact that a lot of these parables, and this is absolutely true, have a triadic structure. And if you pay attention to this triadic structure, each one has at least three lessons. So just think about this, the parable of the prodigal son. There is the father, there is the son that stays at home, and there is the son that goes away, right? Three characters. Matthew 28, the parable of the two sons. There is a father, there is the son who says, yeah, I'm going to do that, but he does it. And then there's the son who says, I'm not going to do that, but then he does it. One, two, three. There are the 10 maidens. Now you say, What do you mean, Allison? That's 11. The groom and no, it's not, because it's what? It's the groom, and then it's five bridesmaids who act as a single character, right? The ones that are ready, and then there are the five that aren't ready. It's really one, two, three. You'd be surprised at how many of the parables are like this. The sheep and the goats. There's the Son of Man, and there are the sheep. And there are the goats. One, two, three. And what this approach says is that, you know, the meaning actually depends on what character you are thinking about. It really does. Parable of the prodigal son. And by the way, if you had good memories, maybe you do, you might be able to think back and realize you've heard several sermons on the parable of the prodigal son. And you probably heard a sermon which focuses on the character of the father, which tells you about the character of God. And then you've probably heard a sermon all about the guy who stays home and is bitter, isn't really happy with what happens with his brother. And then you've all heard sermons on the prodigal son himself and why he repents and what that means, how he turns and comes back and so on. By the way, I think this is really neat. And I think it's obviously true. A lot of these parables have this sort of triadic structure to them. And that makes them, for me, more interesting because they have multiple meanings. They're complex. There's not just sort of one point to get from them. You can enter them from different points of view, and you can take up different characters and ask different questions. And with that, on to number five. Here we see, this is a small pile. No, it's very small. And I'm going to call this the Christological pile. And in here is a book by one of my academic heroes, an old British scholar named C.H. Dodd. He's dated in very many ways, but of course everybody who lived before the present is dated in many ways, right? So that's not to be held against him. But when I was young and in love for the first time and was going to marry a particular woman, she told me that she wasn't going to marry me. She was going to marry our pastor. And it was sort of Romeo and Juliet. I'm going to kill myself. I can't go on with life. And I remember reading a book by C.H. Dodd soon after she told me about this. And I thought, you know what? If living gives me experiences like reading C.H. Dodd, then I can go on without what's-her-face. Anyway, so this view says, you know what, everybody? You're focusing on ethics. You're focusing on eschatology. You're missing something really big, really, really important. The parables are actually, and Karl Barth would be here, they're really about Christ or Jesus. They're Christology because everything is run through him. Now just think about this. We have the parable of the 10 maidens, and then we have the bridegroom. Who is it? Who's the bridegroom? Who is the bridegroom? Nobody ever thinks twice about this. This is a symbol for Jesus. The sower. The sower sows seeds. Who the heck is the sower? Well, it's obvious. The sower is the Son of Man. The sheep and the goats. Who is the king? Who is the king? Who's the judge? Who sorts? The composer of the parable. The person who's speaking. The lost sheep. Who goes after the lost sheep? This has something to do with the ministry of Jesus, and he's the one who's going after the lost sheep. Now, you can go through parable after parable after parable, and you can come up with Christological lessons. And this is obvious, and it's really important, and it's central to understanding the parables. You know from these parables that Jesus is some kind of king. He's some kind of savior. He's some kind of really authoritative teacher. He's some kind of lord or master. His words are life and death. So these are not just nice stories about how we should behave. And they're not even just nice stories about God. They are, in great degree, stories about Jesus. He's not just the speaker, but he's a character in the parables, time and time and time again. So they say something about him. You know, it's kind of like the Sermon on the Mount. People often read the Sermon on the Mount and think, oh, wow, this is about ethics. In fact, you can even see some textbooks, ethics textbooks, which will have Matthew 5, 6, and 7, you know, as a sample of ethics, right? You know, there'll be Kant and Aristotle, and there's Jesus. And it's just pulled out of context, and it's ethics. But you read the Sermon on the Mount, it's Christology. Who's the Lord? Who's Lord in the Sermon on the Mount? It's Jesus. Who's the guy whose words are life and death? And if you do them, then it's okay. You've built your house on a rock. And if you haven't built your house on his words, well, the storms will come. It'll be washed away. Who's the guy who says, you've heard that it was said to those of old by Moses on Sinai, but I say to you, who the heck is this guy? And not only that, but it's a really fascinating experiment to go through the Sermon on the Mount to see what Jesus tells people to do and then to compare that with what he does. I mean, he says, be merciful, and he is merciful. He says, be meek, and he is meek. He talks about those persecuted for righteousness, and he is so. He talks about turning the other cheek. He actually literally does this in the Passion narrative. So, these parables are all about Christology. They are. So there you go. On to six. Pile number six. I count two books there. There are only two books there. But they're really interesting and fun, even if they're all bunk. So I would call these psychologizing. And again, they interest me as an historian. So you can read these parables and say, what about the psychology of the person who composed them? Let's assume he composed most of these. What do they tell us? Well, these two books say they are entrees into Jesus' psyche. How come there are fathers in these parables and there are no mothers? Why are there sons and there aren't many daughters? And people have looked at this and said, this is interesting. This is a post-Freudian age, right? What does this mean? And some people have said, well, you know what? Joseph is there in the infancy narratives, but he's not there during the ministry. So he must have died when Jesus was real young. So what does that mean? Well, you know, you idolize your fathers often when you're young, and then the older you get, maybe the shine comes off a little bit. But the theory here, the psychological theory, is Joseph died when Jesus was still pretty young. So he had this wonderful picture of his father. Wonderful picture of his father. And so he idealized it, and it was natural to project that onto God. Other people have said, well, I mean, one of the books says that, the other book says this. Well, he didn't have a father, so he used God as the substitute, right? He needed a father, didn't have one. And then this gets tied in with other things, too, that are really kind of fun, like, well, he's the firstborn son. And what is the firstborn son supposed to do? Stay home and take care of mom if dad is dead. What does Jesus do? He runs off. He's tramping around the countryside. He's not taking care of Mary. And there are these really interesting hints of the gospel of tension between Jesus and his family. And so maybe he didn't get along so well with his mother. There are no Roman Catholics in this room, I hope. Okay, so here's the seventh view. We move on quickly from the that, and there's only one book here, but I read it on, what, Friday, and I was really taken with this book. It's written by a UK hospital chaplain, and he says that the parables are and were intended to be therapeutic instruments. He says Jesus was all about healing, and not just healing people, you know, who were ill, physically ill, but dealing with psychological, mental issues, demoniacs, and so on. And what this pastor, what this chaplain did, is he decided to take these parables and just hand them as stories to patients in the hospital that he thought needed some help or encouragement. And he just asked open-ended questions. Why do you like this story? Why do you not like this story? What character do you identify with? Why? Who does that character remind you of? Just these totally open questions. And I'm not a psychologist. I know nothing about any of that psychology stuff. I don't know anything about myself even. But these stories are really touching. Just open-ended stories, letting people read themselves into them. And it reminded me of an old book from the 1970s. I'm old enough to remember this. Some of you might know the name Walter Wink. Walter became a sort of, I don't know. He was a New Testament scholar originally, His first book is historical critical stuff. He decided that wasn't very helpful. And one of the things he did is he wrote a book called The Bible and Human Transformation. And he would have people read themselves into the stories and the biblical text. And this reminded me a little bit of that. Anyway, our time is drawing near. The end is coming. So the eighth pile here, it's really interesting because they're all from the last 30 years, and there seem to be more the closer we get to the present. Now, this pile says that Christians, readers of the Bible, have tended to over-theologize and spiritualize the parables. And if we want to get back to Jesus himself, what we need to ask is, what would first century Galileans have made of these stories? And people who weren't living with Christian theology in their heads. And these books are actually focusing on concrete social and economic circumstances and asking questions, well, could this parable have addressed this actually concrete social or economic issue? It's taking the parables out of their frames as they exist in the gospel, their literary frames, and then putting them back in Galilee in AD 30 and saying what's going on at the time and what would Mediterranean peasants have understood hearing these things. And the tendency here is what you see with some people who look at the Lord's Prayer and say, well, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Maybe originally that wasn't about sin. Maybe that was actually about debt, right? So asking the question, have we sometimes turned social and political things into religious or theological things? There are many examples of this now, but I'll just give you one because we have to move on. There's a parable in which a master has servants, and this master is very, very rich, and then gives these retainers some money, and they're supposed to invest the money, and one of them buries the money that they're given. So one interpreter has said, you know what? Okay, I'm just going to read this. And don't worry about the details, but you can see the point. The point is, he's not asking theological questions. He's saying, maybe this really was about retainers and rich people and peasants. So how would you react to a whistleblower? Would a former retainer find a welcome in a peasant village? That's an interesting question. Or would the former hostilities suffocate even the possibility of a latter-day coalition? Do the people of the land realize the role played by retainers, these people in the middle, not the people who have everything up above, but the people who are working for them? Do they understand how their bitter animosity towards them plays into the hands of the ruling elite? He's asking economic and social questions, right? And it really is interesting. What do Jesus's hearers originally think of some of this stuff? Maybe sometimes when Jesus is talking about the land, he means the land, or money, maybe he means money. Can peasants and rural poor folks realize how their interests can be tied to the very class of people whom they despise? Okay. Now, you would expect this thing, I suppose, in our modern post-Marxist context. Nonetheless, some of this makes sense. Okay, I have two more piles here. The next pile is small, but it has one best-selling book in it. And I'm just going to call these the Jewish or rabbinic approach. Jewish or rabbinic approach. Jesus spoke in parables, but he wasn't the only one to speak in parables. And rabbinic literature has lots of parables. Lots of them, folks. And maybe the real key to Jesus' parables is to looking at what other people did with his parables and compare Jesus' parables to theirs. What is he doing that's new? What is he doing that is traditional? Now, to drive home what this is about, I'm actually going to read some of these short parables. You might have a moment or two of recognition. Two rabbis once lived in Ashkelon. They ate and drank together and occupied themselves with the study of Torah. One of them died, and no one accompanied his body to the grave. At the same time, a rich man named Mayan died, and the entire city turned out and followed his body to the grave. Right? So rich man, poor man. The surviving rabbi then said to himself, "Whoa, nothing happens to the wicked." But afterward, he saw a vision and a dream in which he saw his companion walking in the garden of paradise under trees and by wells of water. And he also saw the tax collector, and his tongue sought to drink at the brink of a river. He tried to reach the water, but he could not. So if you know Luke 16, that sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? Really does sound kind of familiar. Okay, listen to this. Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai said a parable. It is like a king who summoned his servants to a banquet. By the way, Jesus has a parable like that. Without appointing a time, the wise ones adorned themselves and sat at the door of the palace, and they said, "Is anything lacking in a royal palace?" The fools went about their work, saying, "Can there be a banquet without preparations?" Suddenly the king desired the presence of his servants. The wise entered adorned, while the fools entered soiled. The king rejoiced at the wise, but was angry with the fools. This is like Matthew 25, isn't it? We have two groups, one ready and one not ready. And it's even in Matthew even has this parable. You may not remember it. In Matthew 22, where a guy has soiled garments, he gets kicked out. All these elements are in this tiny little parable, and they're in Jesus' parables. What's going on here? What is going on here? All right, how about this one? A parable. Unto what is the matter like? It is like a king who hired many laborers, and along with them was one laborer that had worked for him many days. All the laborers went to receive their pay for the day, and this one, this special laborer went also. He said to this one special laborer, "I will have regard for you. The others who have worked for me only a little, to them I will give a small pay." It's actually the opposite of a parable of Jesus. It's the opposite. It's the same storyline, but it's the opposite. Is that just a coincidence? Okay, there are people who say no, that there's a tradition of telling parables, and Jesus is part of it. And sometimes he's saying things similar to what others said. Sometimes, though, he's giving a new ending or twisting the meaning or adding his own elements. A parable, it is like a king who owned a field and who gave it over to renters. They took it but robbed the owner. Then he took it away from them and gave it to their children, but they turned out to be even worse than the others. Then a son was born to the king, and he said to them, "Get out of my possession. You no longer remain there. Give me back my portion." That's not exactly Mark 12, but it's kind of close. It's kind of close, isn't it? Now, I suppose the most important thing to emphasize in this sort of audience is that one of the things these books do, including the bestseller, is to remind us and to show us how often Christians have taken the parables and used them in anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic ways. And much of the... So I personally think Jesus did have conflict with some of his contemporaries. So some of the negative words have their origin in his own controversial setting. But Christians have taken these out of that setting, which is all inside Judaism. Everybody is a Jew, and then make stereotypes about Jewish people and Judaism and so on. And that's, at least in my mind, something we need to repent of. Okay, now we come to the final pile. And it is the right one. The truth is here. So I'm not just saying, here we go, we got all this, and you know, live and let live, postmodern relativism. Nah, not that. Not that at all. So I wish I had a better term, but I'm going to call this the variegated thematic approach. Now, what does that mean? It means this. Some of these parables are allegories and some are not. And probably a couple of them, maybe more, from the beginning had symbolic dimensions to them. Some teach moral lessons, but not all. Some do, but not all. A lot of them do have to do with eschatology, but not all of them. Other things are going on too. There's a lot about Christology, but other things are going on too. Many have three characters or groups, but some don't. Some rework, I think, traditional Jewish parables, but some don't. I don't think that any single approach is appropriate because the parables don't do one thing, and they are not one thing. We can be sort of led astray by the parables. But I don't think that's really more helpful than saying the sayings of Jesus, because there are all sorts of different sayings of Jesus, and they do different things. They function differently and so on. So several themes are recurrent or frequently present, but they're never invariably present, no. Some rhetorical features recur, but not invariably. Some of these are short, real short, real short. They're one-sentencers, and some are a little longer. They're different in length. Sometimes they come with explanations, sometimes they don't. And I'd actually guess that maybe that happened with Jesus himself. Maybe some of them came with explanations and some of them didn't. Some of them are simple, some of them are complex. I think some were intended to illustrate and some probably to provoke reflection. Just what the heck was that? Got to think about it. I think sometimes they were meant to encourage, and I think sometimes they were meant to rebuke or warn. So we should resist making any one theme central to all of them or to privilege any one approach. I actually find value in all of these. Something is to be said for all of them, and I think this is a case where we really can learn from everybody. Okay. Now, I've gone past the 10-15 point, but I want to add two footnotes very briefly. So here's the first thing. There is a strong tendency, has been in these books, ever since we got out of pile one, very strong tendency to take the parables out of their literary context or out of the Gospels and then to put them in another frame of reference that the author or the historian or critic or exegete gives, right? But I personally think that since the evangelists offer us the earliest interpretations of these parables, we should pay attention to them and we should pay attention to their context. After all, again, these are the earliest interpretations we have. And sometimes I do think, you know what? What's the chance of somebody coming up with a new reading in the 21st century, especially when these things have been read for 2,000 years? I'm going to go with Matthew rather than the newfangled thing. So I understand, because I do it myself. I take things outside of the gospel and say, okay, what did this mean, you know, before Easter or to Jesus' original audience? I do that sort of thing. But you don't want to forget that we're pulling them out of context, and I think the contexts are helpful both historically, not to mention theologically. And here's the very last thing of all, which I leave you with, and it has nothing to do with anything, except that it's a parable. So I mentioned the Gospel of Thomas earlier. I'm not a big fan. It's fascinating, but you know, I don't think it's a great source for the historical Jesus. The Gospel of Thomas was discovered, as I said, it's in Coptic, which is a last form of the, never mind. It's in Coptic. It's an Egyptian language. And some of the sayings attributed to Jesus, it's just a collection of sayings. Jesus said, Jesus said, Jesus said, Jesus said. And some of these are just like what you have in the Gospels. A lot of them aren't like what you have in the Gospels. They're very different, and a lot of them I know Jesus didn't say. But there's one, I don't know whether Jesus said it, but I love it. And it's one of these things that I first read this years ago, and I remember it. I think about it once in a while, and I don't know what it means. It's just, I think, wonderful. So you may not, but we're done with this. Okay. This is a very short parable from the Gospel of Thomas. The kingdom of the Father is like a certain woman who was carrying a jar full of meal. While she was walking on the road, some distance from home, the handle of the jar broke, and the meal emptied out behind her on the road. She did not realize it. She had noticed no accident. When she reached her house, she set the jar down and found it empty. I have no idea what that means, but I really like it. Okay, I don't know if we have time for a question or whether I just sit down now.
John, are you coming towards me? Okay, I think we're going to take one question, and then we're going to, there we go. Go for it, John.
One question. Okay, thank you very much. That was absolutely marvelous. Unfortunately, you may not have heard, but the building on that side has fallen down, and they're worried about this side falling down, too. So we've all got to get out of here within 30 seconds, and you can only take one pile with you. You have to take one pile, but only one pile. Okay, which one of those piles are you going to take?
The last one, 10.
Dale, you did it, and you did it very well. Thank you for being here. So friends, our Lenten journey continues next week. We're going to have Bill Krager speaking on his favorite parable, and I am fascinated to hear what books from what piles he picks and what resonates with him. And come next week, keep coming.